Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Seven boats are circling above me. They're getting so upset. They're hungry for some fresh meat, but I ain't dead yet. Yes, I'm getting mighty, mighty weary. I'll get up and go done get. But I got lots of fight left. No, I ain't dead yet. That old sun is way up high. It's in the sky. I'm getting kinda dry. I'll just keep on pushing on. Ain't gonna hang my head and cry. There's still seven vultures circling above me. They're getting so upset. They'll have to find death somewhere else, 'cause I ain't dead yet.
How insane is that?
The Hot Texas Swing Band.
Oh my God, I ain't dead yet. Woo! Kind of fits in with tonight's author.
Absolutely.
Hey, this is another Thursday on your calendar, and you are listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina. I'm coming down with a cold or something. And in studio with, of course, Bobby Jean Bell. I'm so happy that you're here. And her husband, Jim. Hi, Jim. And it's always like Christmas when you're in here, because we get to have so much fun.
We do.
I know, huh? Okay, well, the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing. Nice folks at Black Dog. If you are a new writer and new writers only, give us a call. We'll help you with your editing, your proofreading, formatting, whatever you need to get started in the printing industry or the writing industry. And, of course, where's your thingy here? out west. It's your thingy was hidden.
Yeah.
But the Black Dog's number is 805-795-3165, and I'd be happy to take your phone call. And Out West, which is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. National brands include the Scully Leather Company, Rockmount Ranchwear. Did you say they're out of business?
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Rockmount.
No, Billy Martin's wonderful Western store that used to be in Hollywood.
Gotcha. Dan Post Boots and American West Handbags, just to name a few. If you want to give them a call, their number, their toll-free number, is 877-340-9378. And if you want to get interested in their concert series, that number is a direct line at 661-347-9700. They have a concert. They do a concert the last Friday of the month.
Yeah, and the next one's June 23rd, and that music that kicked us off is by that band, the Hot Texas Swing Band. Coming in from Texas, and they will be with us on June 23rd.
And then, of course, by our favorite sponsors. Take it away.
And we are so happy to have Target Freight with us. Since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. Not only are they the very best at what they do, but they strive to make your shipping experience with a full truckload unparalleled. Call TFM, Target Freight Truckload, today at 1-844-653-7789. Ask for Mike Matruski and tell him you heard it on The Writer's Block, and TFM will have a little something extra for you. And if you are an LTL shipper, getting your freight moved your way, the most expedient way possible, is what you want. One stop, no hassle. Call Target Freight Management today. Their customized traffic program is the finest in the industry. So call 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfreight.com. targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today. Don't delay.
Don't delay. Call today. Yay. If you didn't write those numbers down, you can always call and ask Bobby what they are again.
Sure.
Speaking of calling, if you want to call in tonight and talk to our author, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929, and we always answer the phone if we are able. There are some times when I just can't get this damn thing to work, and I don't answer it.
One of these days, it's live radio. One of these days, we will learn how to answer the phone.
We will.
Let us practice tonight.
And you know, last week, you probably listened to the show.
It was great.
And Russ was giving me a hard time. He goes, you know, you really talk a lot. And I said, Russ, this is talk radio.
This is talk radio. And you answered the calls just fine last week.
I know.
Also.
Well, Henry called.
Well, and also you had a couple callers that called
Two
to talk to
for Peggy.
Yeah. It was really fun.
She's matched the record now. I think the record is two, and she's met the record.
And if you didn't catch us last week, the guest was Peggy Wheeler, and the book was The Raven's Daughter. It's a wonderful interview, and you can listen to that podcast at latalkradio.com, The Writer's Block, or iTunes.
Correct.
Or go to our Facebook page, where we always post the podcast links from past shows.
Correct.
And join in the fun.
Correct. And one more little announcement. On the 17th of this month, I personally have a book signing at the $5 or less bookstore in Simi Valley. And it is from 10 to 2. And we're going to have little discussions on writing. We'll have little conversations. Richard Polinelli has promised he'll show up. He's going to try to sneak in some of his own books, but we'll see if that works out for him.
I bet it will.
I just actually went to his book signing the other day.
Did you?
Yes.
I knew he had one Sunday, right?
No, it was...
Was it Monday?
Golly, what day was it? It was the 30th, so that was what? Tuesday.
Oh.
It was Tuesday at... It was at 2 o'clock,
oh, okay.
2 to 4 at Starbucks, mm-hmm. in Country Club Drive and Wood Ranch in Simi Valley. Yeah, it was a pretty nice little corner he had set up for himself. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cool. Okay, tonight's guest has graduated from Carnegie Mellon University with a minor in creative writing, major in computer science, and promptly did nothing with it for 20 years. After a couple decades of producing lots of software and 5 children, we have to get into that with him. I felt a call to write again. So he wrote his first novel in 2012, found a publisher in 2014, and he now has 2 novels out, and probably 3 by interview time. I don't know if he does, but we're going to find out here in just a moment. Will you please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Travis Norwood. Travis, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Do you have that third novel by interview time?
Yeah, literally, just in this month, submitted it to the publisher, and it is actually a trilogy. We're going to do all at once. So the whole thing will come out at once. It hasn't. We just got it to them, so they're still looking at it.
Cool.
Wow. Can you share the working title?
Yeah, the working title is Abandonment. Mm. That's the series title. And then each book has its own title.
Right.
Uh huh. Okay. Well, Bobby and I both read your Sugar Scars.
Sugar Scars.
Was that your first novel or your second?
That was the first published.
Okay.
It's actually the third one I wrote.
Gotcha.
But we decided to go with that one first.
Gotcha. And I have to say that it was a phenomenal book.
Thank you.
It's not something that I would pick up off the shelf to read. As most of us, you know, we have our genres that we like. But I have to say that once I turned the page, the first page on it, I was hooked.
There were lots of twists and turns, weren't there, Jim?
Oh, my God. There's so many. It's got so many spoiler alerts in there,
you can't give
anything away.
We've been talking, Travis, before tonight's show in the green room here, kind of like, okay, we want to talk about this. Uh-oh, we better not, because then we'd be giving something away.
Yeah. I mean, it's like every chapter you're going to give something away.
Every chapter, almost, I try to, it's written very much like a thriller.
Yes.
I think we officially classified it under science fiction, but it's the lightest form of science fiction. Just this one little premise that's sci-fi, and the rest is very much like a thriller.
Well, yeah, it is.
So go ahead and tell us a little bit about Sugar Scars.
Okay, so it's very common nowadays. If somebody says, I have a book that's about the end of the world, I mean, there's TV shows everywhere. Everybody's the end of the world, the apocalypse, and the general idea is sort of a very Walking Dead kind of, everything's bleak and Mad Max and everybody's killing each other. And I wanted to do something different. And so I was, what happens here is you've got the very normal premise of a virus kills all but one in 10,000 people, leaving a world populated with virtually no one. But instead of focusing on the typical how does a normal person survive, this book says when you're left in a world with no one there, you have almost unlimited resources. Survival wouldn't really be a problem. And so I focus on a character that said, who would have trouble surviving in a world like that? And the character I focus on is a diabetic, because they literally have to have the product of civilization, which is insulin, to survive. Mm-hmm. And otherwise it's a certain death sentence. And so the main character of the novel, after she realizes that she's one of the few people that are immune, realizes, I have to have insulin to live, and I will die without it, because, you know, people just a century ago, insulin was a certain death sentence. And so the novel is the story of her figuring out, how am I going to survive, because civilization is what keeps her alive, is the manufacturing system that keeps the insulin flowing.
And she doesn't realize, it takes her a little bit to realize that insulin expires.
Yeah, and which I remember thinking, I wonder if there's actually a number of people, I thought a number of readers would think, oh, who wouldn't think of that? And a lot of people were surprised when they hit that in the book, when she makes that realization. And they're like, I didn't think of it either. And in my day job, I actually work with pharmaceutical stuff, and so that's something you think about. But a lot of people, it didn't cross their mind, because so much of civilization just, so many things just magically work for us.
Yeah.
In the world, they just, you know, you don't think about where does this come from, where does that come from, how would this keep work? If I had to do this from the ground up, how would I do that? And that's what she has to discover, because, like in my found out in research, in about 1920, these two guys, you know, when diabetes was a death sentence, these two scientists and doctors figured it out, and that's what she has to sort of reverse engineer it.
Right.
Go through this. All the struggles that happen during that.
Right, right. You know, you've also had a nice touch on that, in that she was collecting all this insulin and had refrigerators full of it. And then when she found out that it does have an expiration date, now she's got insulin that's going to expire next week, next month, 6 months, 8 months, you know, 9 months, 12 months down the road, and 2 years is her max. Which I thought was really a nice touch, because now she's got 2 years.
Because really, she could have gotten in any number of vehicles, you know,
right.
Made her way across the country, going to other, she's very resourceful,
right.
She figures out, you know, pharmacies and how to get into places,
right.
And all. And she could have just, like, moved out of Tallahassee,
right.
And found her way across the country, which could have also been interesting as she would go into community. But all insulin's going to expire.
Yeah.
Right.
So. And that's pretty realistic from the research I did, is that's about, no one quite knows, because no one says, let's see how far a human, you know, you can't ever run that trial of, let's give a person expired insulin until they die.
Right.
But they think it's going to be around that amount of time, roughly 2 years. And so that's what I picked for the novel. And that's the clock that sets.
Right.
And it turns out it's really difficult especially when you're not a scientist to, it's really difficult and really very bloody to actually make insulin that works.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing, and not knowing much about the history of insulin, it's like, how did those two doctors really figure all that out? Because
yeah.
We see it in reverse, how many days and all of what they have to go through. You kind of wonder, like, how did it ever happen in the beginning?
It's a really neat story. I've actually, on my website, a little while ago, I published an article, a short story called The Insulin Miracle, that talks about that. But when I researched it, it's one of the few times in modern medicine where you have what people would, that emotionally feels like a miracle. You know, normally you go to the doctor and you say, I have this problem, and they say, here's some medicine, in 3 or 4 days you'll get better. And it turns, you know, probably you would have got better in 3 or 4 days anyway. And there's not much feeling of that. And when they first made insulin, they had these wards of children that were just came to die, basically,
mm-hmm.
Diabetic children. And the scientists who discovered it came in, and when they started on row one and gave insulin shots, by the time they got to patient 10, the first children were coming to life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all their body needed. And it was, you know, not literally a miracle, but it's close to a medical miracle where, like in a movie, somebody mm-hmm. gets a shot and seconds later, this child whom if you imagine your own child, you're thinking, they're going to die, and I'm just waiting on the deathbed, and somebody gave them this shot, and now they're going to live. And it was just incredibly dramatic.
Well, and we learn that pigs play a very important role in this book for a variety of reasons. Again, we don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts, but Jim and I were remembering a book that we read probably a year ago, where that pigs were a very important,
very big part of the book.
Very big part of that book. It's just kind of fun to go back over some of what we've read and make the connections, if you will. Those pigs, though, had a virus, and the pigs in this book seem to have been immune to the to the virus.
The virus has only affected humans, and then pigs are you obviously can't take the insulin from human beings, so she has to get it from, it's either pigs or cows, and it turns out for practical reasons, pigs were the little bit easier choice.
Plus they have a lot of meat.
May I ask why you chose to write in the first person and that the character is female?
Yeah, my other novels are not in the first person, and that one, I wanted the style of there's some times where it's sort of like she's writing a journal and she speaks directly to the audience, and I like that, the tone that comes across, and it just it allows you to get that character's voice, allow me to get that character's voice a lot better, because she's a unique character. She's grown up as an orphan in the foster care system, and she's very introverted and doesn't get along with people, and I like giving, being able to directly speak from her perspective. And I was sort of nervous coming as a man, writing from a female's perspective, but women have said that they could see it. And it's not like every woman, because it's not a generic character. She's very specific, but hopefully it works.
Well, yeah, it seemed to. I found it amazing that you were able to do that and not miss a beat, which I thought was very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's the closest character I've ever written to me. Not exactly. She's very introverted, and so everybody, normally you think of the apocalypse and everybody's dead, and you think of this horror scenario, and there's a certain set of the population, me included, that sometimes think of that, wow, that sounds awesome. Just, you know, I don't want everybody to die, but it, you know, there might be some benefit of me being one of all the few hundred people in the entire United States. It sort of sounds nice to have all this alone time and not all the hassle of people everywhere. And so she sort of had that perspective. She didn't have a family. She was a foster child, and she was like, well, you know, I sort of like this new empty world, except for the fact that the clock is ticking.
And that would be remembering that you just took your five children to the movies.
Yeah. Well, and there is a calmness, like you were saying before, so much of genre around this is much more, you know, terrorism or guns, things exploding and violence. And, you know, we have a little bit of that in when you take us to Brazil. But there's kind of a calmness to this very quiet landscape. I mean, it's just nature until we have a hurricane,
sort of,
you know?
An anti-apocalypse where it's not, like I said, it's not a Walking Dead with zombies everywhere, where you're thinking the environment is not her struggle. Her body is the challenge.
Right.
And everybody else is like, hey, we're sad, but we're going to, I made it clear that they had plenty of gasoline. You know, you think about going to a grocery store, and there's five grocery stores for every person. That, you know, you're not going to have food issues for years. So the entire thing is structured. The enemy is her body.
Right.
I like books that don't have, you know, there's no mustache twirling villain. It's just,
well, there was in Brazil.
Well, there was in Brazil. So, yes.
That was the one time where they actually had somebody who opposed.
As a matter of fact, it struck me odd is that Brazil was where the bad guys were. Uh-huh. But in the United States, she didn't run across any, except for the one guy, the fire bomber.
Yes, and Michael.
Well,
kind of.
Yeah,
a different kind of.
And that's sort of the perspective is I wanted to put any of the villainy far away to say the world she lives in is actually okay, mm-hmm. because the whole struggle, the villain is her body in this case. And there's a lot of people who deal with that, where the challenge in their life is completely internal. It's either the literal, the diabetics, or the challenges against their body. But that's a very common thing, is the struggle against yourself, really.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the fact that the bad guys probably don't want to go to Tallahassee. I certainly don't want to go to Taliban.
She's interesting in other ways, too. She's got a head for numbers.
Yes.
That was very interesting to me.
Yeah, and I gave her, she's not autistic, but she has a savant-like ability with numbers. That to me made her much more interesting, and it gave, I'm very mathematical. I don't have anything like her ability where she can just handle numbers completely, but it gives her a mathematical perspective on the world, which I have a lot, and I like to see that, where you can see a drama situation, but and some of the things in life can be revealed by a mathematical awareness. Like there's times she realizes, where are all the children? Mm-hmm. You know, she has this horrible realization that she looks around the people who's the 20 people in her city that survived, and she's like, if this distributed statistically, there should be some children. And then they all have this sick moment that they realized none of us, we all thought about ourselves. We didn't go searching house to house for all the children who are probably trapped and couldn't get out. And, mm-hmm. and there's this perspective that when you think, she thinks mathematically that allows her to have some insights about the world that you wouldn't normally see.
And did you notice, Jim, she likes to name things.
Yes, she names everything.
She names everything. Tell us a little bit about Bella.
That was my dog.
Yeah.
That was your dog. That's right. Tell us about Bella and Clint.
Bella and Clint.
So she does. She has a, she's a, for the reason people don't know, she's a 19-year-old girl, and she's been in foster care all her life. And we're foster parents, and so I have that insight of what kind of children that the system produces. And so she has a maturity in one respect because she has this life-threatening illness that to be able to handle herself without direct parents, she has to be able to deal with, but also not exposed to the world in the normal family way. She has this immaturity. And one of the things she does is she names everything inanimate objects because she doesn't like people very much. And Bella is her car that she...
Right.
That I hope feels like a character at some point.
Yes.
Well, until about a quarter of the way through the book.
Yes.
Yeah, you'll just see about that. And Clint is the name after Clint Eastwood she gives to a gun. And that's just one of her characteristics, is that she's so not into people that she likes her things better.
Yeah, that was kind of fun
and
about
her. House is named Rosie?
Yeah, the house has a name.
Yeah, you're right.
And the generator and the refrigerator.
Yeah, she names everything.
She names everything.
Everything. I think she kind of like is disgusted when somebody already has a name.
Oh yeah, she doesn't like that.
And I have to ask Travis. I went crazy. I went crazy, absolutely nuts, going through page after page after page of this book, Sugar Scars, and never learning the name of this girl.
Well, right.
So,
yeah.
Do you want to share?
No, that's the secret she's going to keep. Maybe a sequel one day, but she decided the world was wiped clean, and she hated her name that her parents gave her, and that no one would ever find out. So she renamed herself.
I wondered if you would take us back to Tallahassee sometime in the future. Because I
have plans for a sequel.
Do you? Okay.
I know what it's going to be about. And it's obvious when you hit the last line what some of the story elements will be.
Right.
But that you'll have to read the book to find out.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about your experiences with foster and adoptive parenting. You have foster kids now, or you did have foster kids in the past?
We have them all the time. So we started foster parenting in 2010. We had already adopted a child internationally from Kazakhstan in 2005, and he's 12 now.
Okay.
And we started foster parenting in 2010, and we've done everything. We've had a little girl for years, 3 or 4 years, and then we've had, right now we tend to do shorter term ones, although we just had our hearts broken the other day on a little a 6-month old baby that we'd had for 4 months. Took him right out of the hospital, and we had to say goodbye to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had him for as short as 2 hours. We had one that ran away in the middle of the night, and then long as 3 or 4 years. And that's just, it frames, once when you go through those kind of experiences, it lets you see a lot of different perspectives, mm-hmm. of their all in the world. Because you get these children in that are so different, and there's so many things they don't have, and they're so hungry for family. And it just, it influences everything I do. Even if a book doesn't, like in Sugar Scars, the the character was a foster child.
Yes.
It helped work into her introverted character. Even on the books I have that don't directly address that, it helps me to have, I've learned a lot of, as an introverted person like her, I've learned to empathize a lot and be able to see different situations that I've been exposed to through fostering. But it's probably besides my family itself, the dominant factor that's helped me identify with people, which I hope makes me a better writer.
Mm-hmm. And how many foster kids do you have now?
Like I said, we just had a four-month baby move on, and so we don't have any right now. And then tomorrow we're getting two little girls for a little bit.
Oh wow. My goodness.
That'll be our day tomorrow, yeah.
Wow. Are they sisters or...
I can't.
That's okay.
I can't give any details on
that. That's fine. That's fine. I'm sorry. I should not have gone there. Apologies.
Yeah.
Bobby.
I forget we're on the radio. I'm thinking we're sitting around with a cup of coffee.
Incidentally, a cup of coffee, writer's block bug. Yay,
yeah.
Team.
Yeah.
Take a picture of that, Travis, and put it on your website.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Put it on our Facebook page.
Okay.
With you holding the writer's block mug. Those are great mugs.
Yeah.
I love those mugs.
Do you have another process? We're talking a little bit about process.
Process. Or did Let's you go to process.
It? Okay.
Apparently you have a day job.
Yes.
And I'm sure that any writing teacher that you've ever had or writing instructor has told you never give up your day job.
Until you retire, like you, Jim, and then writing
that's
is your
all
day
I do
job.
All day is write.
Write and read. And read. And
play solitaire, and listen to music, and and read books. And then prepare for this show. How do you find time? You have five children at home. How do you find time to sit down and write? When do you find time to do that?
So that's a very common question with people. They see the children all around, and not only the five that we have, but then, of course, every once in a while.
Right.
Frequently have a couple, one or two more. Fundamentally, the answer is if you love something, you'll find time to do it.
Sure.
There's TV shows you don't watch, but a lot of times it's early in the morning or late at night. I used to say when the kids have gone to bed, but now we have a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old, and they never, ever go to bed except for from like 3 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Oh, they keep my hours.
Yeah, keep Bobby. I get emails from Bobby at 3 o'clock in the morning.
So. Yeah,
you just find the time when it. Or I'll sit in the living room while everybody's doing their stuff, and I'm writing on my laptop while they're screaming and making messes and watching TV and whatever it is they do. So.
There you go. I like it.
Do you find that you write kind of every day, or
That is one of those cardinal rules I've heard people say: write every day. And I do not. I write it could be because of the nature of I have a job and a family that I just can't. But I will write in it comes and goes. So I'll I did Sugar Scars, like the first draft in just a couple of months of just intense writing, and that was the only thing I did besides keeping my family alive and maintaining the job. And then it went into the editing process. While somebody else has it, I'll take a break for a while. And I just finished this trilogy, took like a year and a half, and that was, I don't know how that clocks out, but that I would be on and off. It's a feast or famine kind of thing. Mm-hmm. With me. So it's not every day, but when I do it, anything I do, I'm a little one-track mind, is what my wife attests to.
Do you feel like you go into flurries of writing where, you can't stop, you want to finish this chapter, and then you automatically start another chapter, and you go, oh my God, I'm halfway through this chapter. I wasn't going to write that long.
It's like reading a good book.
Exactly.
You want to go and go and go. When you get on a roll writing, you just like, well, I got
Especially especially when you're telling the story, mm-hmm. and you want to know where it goes too.
Mm-hmm. You're kind of in the zone.
You don't always.
You don't wanna,
I always have an idea. I think one of the important things is to always know where your ending is.
Yes.
I think
your beginning and your ending.
We've all read really good books that didn't end well, and I like to always have the ending in mind. But you don't. So I'll have a rough outline, sometimes a literal outline, but it changes. The story isn't. I don't know the exact story when I
right.
When I type the title. A lot evolves over time.
Do you, I'm going to go back to Sugar Scars for just a moment. You introduce a character named Sam, and he's a pilot, and we won't say anything more about him. We don't want to do a spoiler alert, but he's an interesting character, and we meet him, and then you bring him back, and he has a very important role in the book. And I wondered, as I was reading, and I was trying to take off my reader helmet for a moment and kind of put on my, not critique, but reviewer helmet for a moment, and I wondered, did you have Sam, like, part of the story all along, or did you say at some point, oh, I need to be able to have XYZ happen, I'm going to need a pilot, and I'm going to need to put him in the story somewhere. Do you understand that question?
Yeah, exactly. So he originally had a functional role. She needs to be transported in this world where all that has gone away because most people did. But then, so just as a writer to make stories interesting, you say, okay, so I know I have to have this. How can I make that interesting? And I won't reveal too much, but a lot of the theme of the book, like with diabetes, is dealing with internal disability, where the conflict or the struggle is against yourself, and he has that also. He has an internal struggle, where he's left in this world that should be easier to survive in, but he's got an affliction also that he has to deal with and he has to overcome. And you know, and you're hopefully as you're reading your book and thinking, I don't know if he can do it.
But you had him in mind kind of all, I mean, you sort of had him in mind all along. You knew where the action was going to go and that you were going to need that character.
And his skill set.
Okay. I begin to wonder that as I read.
I liked the character.
Oh, yeah. He was delightful.
He was great.
He was great.
He was pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know. And
every character that he introduces plays a really important role.
Extremely important role.
And of course, we know there's only a handful of characters left in the world. So these that you introduce us to each have a very specific, important role in the storytelling and in her life.
Right. Now, the question I have for you, and Bobby and I talked about this in the green room as well. Why plunk a whole bunch of survivors in Tallahassee, Florida?
Why not, I guess, huh?
I live in Montgomery, Alabama, and a lot of the writers would tend to say, well, I'm going to put them where I am. I picked that because it was necessary for a couple of things that happened later in the book with the weather and its location. And I didn't, one of the key things, like I said, the theme is the survival aspect of this book is about surviving her body and the diabetes in her body. So I didn't want to make it like, so if you put it up north, you got to, how do we survive the winter without power questions? But Tallahassee, pretty much, you know, in Florida, weather-wise is very survivable. You won't have questions of how do we live through this, except for you'll see some stuff later in the book. And so that's the core idea of where I picked it is, I wanted everything about the structure, the initial setup is, let's focus, the typical survival story is, how do I eat and how do I keep people from killing me?
Right.
And I eliminate those immediately and say, everybody's nice around here, we got plenty of food, the weather's warm, what's going to happen? Oh yeah, the main character is going to die if she can't make it. I remember I was asking myself, I was like, why isn't every character in books and movies diabetic? Instantly, it's a realistic thing that no one would question for a second, and you have a time bomb. You know, I imagine all these action movies, if you said, let's make one of them diabetic, and it's like, if I don't get my insulin, I'm going to die.
Oh, yeah,
and
James Bond,
it's such a wonderful, dramatic device, and everybody, you get instant believability because everyone knows a diabetic. We take it as something incredibly ordinary nowadays. And there are these incredibly brave people struggling with this every day who literally, if they don't get this, you know, seemingly magical substance, they die. Dramatic that I'm surprised that not more people have used it.
Well, and it regiments their life as well. You know, what's eaten and what time it's eaten and how much is eaten. And there's so much about just daily living to stay alive.
Right. What's the percentage of people in the? I just throw out the United States because there's a whole lot of people in the world. Mm-hmm. What's the percentage of the people in the United States that actually have type 1 diabetes?
Oh, I used to know it a couple of years ago when I did the research.
Somehow I knew you would have
that answer. There's type 1 and there's type 2.
Right. Type 2 is adult onset. Yeah.
Is not acquired.
Well,
I can remember it's like 1%, I think.
Well, and
it
I
could
think
be way lower than that.
She even raises it in her own mind, or somebody asks her, like, huh, did everybody with type 1 diabetes survive the virus? There could be a lot of people looking for insulin out there in New Mexico and California, and who knows, you know?
It's true. Wouldn't that be something if the type 1 diabetes people were immune to this virus?
Well, I think that's one of the fun things about speculative fiction is it opens the reader's mind to other kinds of questions that the author doesn't need to really address. Is you start to think like, oh, that might mean, you know, this or that, or
right,
or
right.
Oh, but what about? And that's always a fun thing for a reader.
I think so. Well, I certainly do think you've captured. Well, once you get into this book, you definitely get our imagination going. And we do have to suspend reality a little bit.
To
get through it, you know, logically. But great read. Great read. The book is Sugar Scars. It's just a wonderful book.
You want to talk about his publisher? You want to ask about the publisher?
I was going to ask about your publisher right now.
It's 7:36. It's a publisher question.
It's a publisher question. Actually, let's get the writer's block question out of the way.
That's usually
first.
At 7:40.
Yeah. Okay, the name of the show is A Writer's Block. Travis, have you ever had writer's block?
So I sort of subscribe to Isaac Asimov's take on that, is if you hit a block, just move on to something else. So I've never hit a period where it's just like, I can't write anything. Sure, any writer, you get to something, you're like, I don't know what happened next. And the solution to that is do something completely different. And say, okay, I'm pausing this.
Okay.
Short story, so I'm going to work on the novel. I'm pausing the novel to work on something else, maybe even a blog post or something. But there's always something that you can write about. And then once you usually, once you hit something else for a while and you come back to it and your brain has worked out the problem in the background.
Oh, sure.
So that's, yeah.
I think once you relax and walk away from it, it's easier to go back to it.
Well, and your blog is really great articles on your blog. I can understand that if you're stymied on something, just go write something on a blog, because your blog articles are terrific.
Hello. We had a writer, Ona Russell. Remember, she went through like a 12-year writer's block.
Uh-huh.
She started a book and took her 12 years to finish it.
Oh, I don't think I'm a relatively fast writer. Once I get going, that's all I think about, and I can get it done. Sugar Scars was pretty easy because I identified with the character. But this trilogy I just finished was a bit more work, but that's just because it's of size. It's a lot of logistics to keep track of, and the stories takes just a lot more to keep in your head and keep going. But I still love it.
So you write whenever you can. So let's talk about your publisher.
Okay. I've gone through a weird publishing journey.
Yeah, I've noticed that. So let's talk about that for a little bit. Your current publisher is?
The current publisher is Dragon Moon Press.
Okay. And we have another writer that uses the same publisher as you. That would be Peggy. She was on last week. Peggy
Wheeler. Yeah.
Right.
And do they do science fiction? Is that what they do primarily?
Yeah, they're science fiction and fantasy.
Okay, science fiction and fantasy.
Maybe exclusively, I think they'd say, yeah.
Yeah, because she writes about shape-shifting ravens.
It looked from their website a lot of really interesting titles that were in that speculative fiction kind of genre.
And you had a publisher before that.
Right, so I went through the traditional path of submitting to agents, submitting to publishers, large number of those, and then eventually I hit with a place that was called Book Trope. They called themselves a hybrid publisher,
right?
And the idea is they're between the hybrid between traditional and self-publishing, and they had a very intriguing model. Now it eventually failed. It died in last April. When a lot of stuff, so it's hard to isolate, was it that concept of publishing that failed, or was it just the victim of so many things that are collapsing in the publishing industry under the weight of Amazon and some of those other ones? And I don't know, but it was a it was the 10-second short of that is they radically reduce cost by having the editor, cover artist, writer, and marketing manager get a percentage of any potential sales versus upfronting. And a lot of people got excited about it for a while. They were really successful for a while. I got in on the first phase, and then they ballooned massively. There was an issue. Did they pull too much in? But it failed eventually, and that could be a huge analysis about that. And, of course, that was heartbreaking to me. But fortunately, I got my foot in the industry, and I got some notice, and I was able to get on with an indie publisher pretty quickly, and they took over those books and were working on some new stuff.
Good enough. Do you have an agent currently?
I do not.
You do not. Do you?
If any are listening, I'd be happy to.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Put it on our Facebook page.
We are going to have, on September 7th, we are going to have a two-hour show that is going to be directed at publishers and agents. So that's something you may want to put on your calendar to listen to. And okay. If you want to call in, of course, I can give you the number. It's 818-602-4929. And if you want to call in and talk to Travis, go ahead. But that's the number here in the studio, and I'm sure we'll have more than one phone call that night. So you're always welcome to call in, and if you got anything going you want to tell us about, rock on.
Okay.
Do you have any words of wisdom for writers?
To keep at it mainly is the main thing. This is the market is so incredibly flooded. That it's very, very difficult to get noticed. And I think most writers don't realize, they go into it thinking it's 80% writing,
sure,
20% other stuff. And it's, sad to say, probably the other ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to think of it, and I'm not claiming I'm great at this, but this is a realization I've had. To succeed, you've got to think of it like a business, and businesses are a lot of marketing and getting noticed.
Right.
And there's the core function of what you do, which would be writing in this case.
Right.
And then you to get people to notice it,
right.
You've got to do the other stuff.
Right.
And so that's and I think a lot of people wouldn't like that because they want the hobby of it. And, you know, there's occasionally somebody like Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, wrote this big novel, threw it on the internet, and had a million readers and a movie in a few years. But, you know, that's literally one in a million.
Right. Well, and to write and get noticed by any of the big publishers, I mean, you know, we're talking the big five now, which all the writers need to, well, you know, I want to be part of the big five. Well, good luck with that. If you know, unless you're John Sanford or Michael, what's his name? Anyway, the guy who writes Harry Bosch, James Patterson, those big, big, big writers, you're not going to get into the big five. You know, everything they do is tied up in, you know, a core bunch of writers, and they're not going to change.
But nowadays you do. Before it used to be you had almost no chance, and then you'd have to say, oh, well. Now there is you can put it out there, and there is a chance.
Well, sure. There's always a chance.
Get a book published nowadays. There's, you know, from self-publishing to something in between.
Right.
I think one of the biggest challenges, and I would say you're absolutely on the money, that there's an inversion now. 80% of your time has to be on marketing and 20 on the creative process. And the tough thing is, if you're a creative spirit, you want to be creating. And when you have limited pockets of time, it's like, how do I find the time to spend on that 80% piece, which is really marketing what I'm creating, and not shortchange my time creating? And
right.
I think every artist, whether it's a musician or an artist or an author, we're all struggling with that.
Mm-hmm.
And even with our online business, how do I spend the find the time to get more product up, or do I spend the time trying to find how to promote the product on social media? So we are all dancing that dance, and it is a change. It's a paradigm. It's more than a paradigm shift.
Right.
It's a total change,
right.
And we're grappling with it.
And they when we were as the first publisher, they would drill into your heads with that, like blog, 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 which I don't do that often, especially with I've been working on the trilogy, and they were saying two or three blog posts a week, and I was like, mm-hmm. That's insane. I have to write also, but I did have. At first, I didn't believe it at all, and then I had a post. I just threw it out. I'd wrote it an hour, put it out there, and it went viral, and I got hundreds of thousands of views on it, and that led to a little spike in sales. But you can't – you sit down to write the next one and say, okay, I'm going to write a viral post, and you go like, I have no idea how I did the first one.
Yeah.
You can't depend on that.
And even trying to keep up with the trend, it was blog and still is, but then there's, you know, Facebook Live now, and people are, you know, and there's interviewing on YouTube. You know, there's so many places, and how do you keep ahead of whatever the trend is, where people are going to see, you know, would they True. Rather listen to you being interviewed and you're doing a vlog, or you're doing a live Facebook, hey, it's me and I'm going to talk about something, or do we want to read what mm-hmm. you're writing? I think that's the other challenge, is how do we keep up with it?
It's
there's a lot
hard.
Of people that hit that unfortunately will get it vice versa, and you can tell that they're mainly a promotional entity, promote, and hey, I've also got a book. And I want to be a writer first, and then hopefully also do some promotion.
Right.
Because if you turn out real good quality work and then do some marketing, there's a chance you'll get attention. But I don't want to be attention, and then bring it all to a lousy
right.
work. So
fundamentally,
do a good produce good work first.
Well, no matter whether you indie publish or you go through a publisher, you still have to shamelessly self-promote.
Mm-hmm, you do.
And that's just the deal. I mean, you know, you got to get your butt out there and promote yourself. And if you don't do that, you can't rely on the internet to push you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writers now are being pushed forward by word of mouth. And I think that's probably, I would say, 80% of the...
Well, and that's always been one of the very best ways.
And that's always been the best way to get your work read, is the word of mouth. Going out there with a sandwich board on your back and saying, hey, you know, read this book by so-and-so.
Yeah, and somebody saying, you got to read this, I just read it.
Exactly.
You know, it's still that personal referral.
Because even the big publishers don't do that much promotions mm-hmm. anymore. They don't, you know, there's no book tours anymore. They don't, so... we're running out of time, Travis. We need. Why don't you tell our audience where they can find you, and your email and your website and Facebook and all that stuff.
The website is easy. It's travisnorwood.com, and they can go there and see what I post. They can sign up for a email thing, which I will not send too often, just to let people know when new books come out and stuff, so it's not going to get spammed. And they can write me at travis@travisnorwood.com. And I'm on Twitter at Travis L. Norwood, and then on Facebook, it's just Facebook/ Travis Norwood author.
Okay.
I'm all those, and you can get in touch with me, and I do respond. If people write in, I will communicate with them. I'd love to hear from people who have read the book.
Everybody says that, but how many really do?
Test me and find out.
Well, there you go. We'll do that. Hey, thanks for spending this time with us tonight, Travis. Enjoyed having you on the show. Good. I'm glad you did. And enjoy that coffee mug.
Keep writing. Keep writing. Keep reading.
Keep writing. Keep reading. And raise those five kids.
I will.
Okay. Take care, my friend. Thank you again
Thank
for
you.
Joining us. Okay.
Okay.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Travis Norwood.
So, Jim, you sent me an email the other day, and you attached to it the cover of your next book that's on the horizon. And I know you maybe have talked about this a little bit with Russ, I think, on a past show. But why don't you just take a moment and tell us what's happening with Jonah Blue?
Jonah Blue is a book that came to me when I was dreaming. He was a dream. And I woke up, and I couldn't shake it. It was there. I mean, even his name was there. I just couldn't get rid of it. So I just sat down, and the story kind of tells itself. He's a 10-year-old boy who runs away from his family's farm in 1830, Ohio, and winds up going up to the Rocky Mountains with a mountain man named Rensfeld Doggett, and he learns how to survive and how to be a mountain man. He goes to rendezvous, and he gets to do all the fun stuff that mountain men get to do. And he finally winds up, when Rennie is killed, he finally winds up with Moon Cromwell, who is also an old mountain man that's been crippled by the Blackfeet. And they travel together, and they travel together for years. It's very cool. And his brother and sister show up, and it's kind of gets a little weird. They're not weird, but... A little different.
I don't want to give it away.
I don't want to give that away.
Do you see this as the beginning of a potential series? Or
I don't think so.
No. Okay.
I think this is definitely going to be a standalone book. Yeah. I'm going to get, you know, when it ends, it's going to end.
So have you have an in-depth knowledge of the West and Western mm-hmm. history and specifics and things. Did you have to do additional kinds of research?
I did. I had to research the mountain men uh-huh. and how they did things and the trapping and when mm-hmm. they trapped for beaver and when they trapped for marten and when they trapped for mink. And I mean, a lot of it was done in the wintertime, mm-hmm. you know, and these guys would be out there wading in these cold cold streams.
Very hard conditions.
And trapping beaver, you know, mm-hmm. and during the summer, the mosquitoes would get so bad that they would take, birch and boil the birch bark down. And it creates a tannin that is repellent for mosquitoes. But they would use that on their horses, and then they would add mink oil to it and use it on themselves.
Interesting.
To keep the, of course, it kept the tannin on them, if you know, because it just run off if it's because it's watery.
Are they trading with the Hudson Bay Company?
They did. Moon was working for the Hudson Bay Company.
Oldest, yeah. I think, still the oldest retailing company in the world.
Yeah, Moon worked for him at Rendezvous.
At Rendezvous.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and they kept running into him. And Jonah, of his first Rendezvous, he was 12 years old. And he first drank a liquor. And he tried to make it with a little Sioux girl and couldn't do it because he was drunk and he's only 12. So.
Although 12 then was probably then like being 25 now, right?
He tells, I'm 10, but I'm going to be 11. I'm going to be a man next week. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be 11. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, it's a fun book to write, and I'm having a ball with it.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And next week on the Writer's Block, we have Doug Figgs.
Doug Figgs is a award-winning singer-songwriter from New Mexico, and we'll be talking about the songwriting process.
And and he's teamed up with Jim Jones on mm-hmm. one of our guests for a CD called The Cowboy Way.
Mm-hmm. Which won a major award, and we'll be talking about that.
We'll be talking about that next week. And then the week following, we have Chelsea Hickman
and
Michael Druxman.
Michael Druxman.
And following after that, we have the twins, Eric Heisner and Al Bringus. And the week following that, we have Henry Park and hopefully Court Joyner. So it's June's turned out to be a pretty good month for us.
Yeah.
And we don't have any more reading this month.
This is show 101,
This is show a live show 101. Yeah. We're pretty stoked with that. Mm-hmm. And real quick, I did go down to a new bookstore that is an indie bookstore only down in the South Bay. And it is called Pipe and Thimble. They are in Lomita. And if you have some time, you run down to Lomita. You have to go down through Crenshaw and stuff to get there. But great place, nice women. It's a mother and a daughter that own it. And it's all they have is indie authors, which is very cool.
Very cool.
It's very cool.
And we sure wish them the best.
Oh, we wish them the best.
Go shop. Go buy books there. Keep them going.
You can submit up to 5 titles, and they like them autographed. So, mm-hmm. That being said, it's been a wonderful night having Bobby back in the studio with me, and yay, yay! And Jim, always good to see you. And another Thursday has gone by, and so now this is the Writer's Block, and we are on LA Talk Radio, and we are out of here.